in nearly every conceivable economic environment. Can you imagine a portfolio model that was down just 3.93% in 2008 when the world was melting down and the market was down 50% from the peak? A portfolio where you can more than likely be safe and secure when the next gut-wrenching crash wipes out trillions of Americans' 401k accounts. This is the gift that lies in what you'll soon listen to. Note that past performance does not guarantee future results. Instead, I am providing you the historical data here to discuss and illustrate the underlying principles. But before we dive in and before you can appreciate the beauty and power of Ray's guidance, let's understand the backstory to one of the most incredible investors and asset allocators to walk the planet. Let's learn why governments and the world's largest corporations have Ray on speed dial so they can maximize their returns and limit their losses. I'm loving it. 1983 was a bad year for chickens. It was the year that McDonald's decided to launch the wildly successful Chicken McNuggets. They were such a hit that it took a few years to work out supply chain issues because they couldn't get their hands on enough birds. But if it wasn't for the genius of Ray Dalio, the Chicken McNugget wouldn't even exist. How does the world of high finance intersect with the fast food selling clown? Because when McDonald's wanted to launch the new food, it was nervous about the rising cost of chicken and having to up its prices. Not an option for its budget-conscious clientele. But the suppliers weren't willing to give a fixed price for its chickens because they knew that it wasn't the chickens that are expensive. It's the cost of feeding them all that corn and soy meal. And if the feed costs rise, the suppliers would have to eat the losses. McDonald's called Ray, knowing that he is one of the world's most gifted minds when it comes to eliminating or minimizing risk while maximizing upside. And he rang up a solution. He put together a custom futures contract, translation, a guarantee against future rising prices of corn and soy meal, which allowed suppliers to be comfortable selling their chickens for a fixed price. Bon appetit. Ray's expertise extends far beyond the boardrooms of major corporations. Just how far does his wisdom reverberate throughout the world? In 1997, when the U.S. Treasury decided to issue inflation-protected bonds, today they are commonly known as TIPS, officials came to Ray's firm, Bridgewater, to seek advice on how to structure them. Bridgewater's recommendations led to the current design of TIPS. Ray is more than just a money manager. He is a master of markets and risk. He knows how to put the pieces together to tilt the odds, winning drastically in favor of him and his clients. So how does Ray do it? What's his secret? Let's sit at the feet of this economic master and let him take us on a journey. Intellectual Navy Seals. Remember the jungle metaphor he gave us way back in Chapter 1? As Ray sees it, to get what we really want in life, we have to go through the jungle to get to the other side. The jungle is dangerous because of the unknowns. It's the challenges lurking behind the next bend that can hurt you. So in order to get to where you want to go, you have to surround yourself with the smartest minds that you also respect. Ray's firm, Bridgewater, is his personal team of jungle masters. He has over 1,500 employees who are almost as obsessed as Ray with figuring out how to maximize returns and minimize risk. As I mentioned early on, Bridgewater is the world's largest hedge fund manager, with nearly $160 billion under its watch. This amount is astonishing considering most big hedge funds these days hover around $15 billion. Although the average investor has never heard of Ray, his name echoes in the halls of the highest places. His daily observations, a daily report, are read by the most powerful figures in finance, from the heads of central banks to those in foreign governments and even the President of the United States. There is a reason why the world's biggest players, from the largest pension funds to the sovereign wealth funds of foreign countries, invest with Ray. And here is a clue. It's not conventional wisdom. He thinks way outside the box. Heck, he shatters the box. And his voracious appetite to continually learn and challenge the conventional and find the truth is what propelled Ray from his first office, his apartment, to a sprawling campus in Connecticut. His jungle team at Bridgewater has been called a group of intellectual Navy SEALs. Why? Because by working at Bridgewater, you are going through the jungle with Ray, arm in arm. The culture requires you to be creative, insightful, and courageous, always able to defend your position or views. But Ray also requires you to have the willingness to question or even attack anything you consider faulty. The mission is to find out what is true and then figure the best way to deal with it. This approach requires radical openness, radical truth, and radical transparency. The survival and success of the entire firm depends on it. Alpha Dog. Ray Dalio put himself on the map with the extraordinary and continual success of his Pure Alpha strategy. Launched in 1991, the strategy now has $80 billion and has produced a mind-boggling return of 21% annualized return before fees were taken out and with relatively low risk. The fund's investors include the world's wealthiest individuals, governments, and pension funds. It's the 1% of the 1% of the 1%, and the club has been closed to new investors for many years. The Pure Alpha strategy is actively managed, meaning that Ray and his team are continuously looking for opportunistic investments. They want to get in at the right time and get out at the right time. They aren't just riding the markets, which was evidenced by a 17% gain before fees in 2008, while many hedge fund managers were closing their doors or begging investors not to pull out. The investors in Pure Alpha strategy want big rewards and are willing to take risk, albeit still limiting their risk as much as humanly possible. Children and charity. With incredible success managing the Pure Alpha strategy, Ray has built up quite a sizable personal nest egg. Back in the mid-90s, he began to think about his legacy and the funds he wanted to leave behind, but he wondered, what type of portfolio would I use if I wasn't around to actively manage the money any longer? What type of portfolio would outlive his own decision-making and continue to support his children and philanthropic efforts decades from now? Ray knew that conventional wisdom and conventional portfolio management would leave him in the hands of a model that continually shows that it can't survive when times get tough. So he began to explore whether or not he could put together a portfolio, an asset allocation, that would do well in any economic environment in the future. Whether it's another brutal winter like 2008, a depression, a recession, or so on. Because nobody knows what will happen 5 years from now, let alone 20 or 30 years out. The results? A completely new way to look at asset allocation. A new set of rules. And only after the portfolio had been tested all the way back to 1925, and only after it produced stellar results for Ray's personal family trust in a variety of economic conditions, did he begin to offer it to a select group. So long as they had the minimum $100 million investment, of course. The new strategy, known as the All-Weather Strategy, made its public debut in 1996, just 4 years before a massive market correction put it to the test. It passed with flying colors. Questions are the answer. We've all heard the maxim, ask and you shall receive. But if you ask better questions, you'll get better answers. It's the common denominator of all highly successful people. Bill Gates didn't ask, how do I build the best software in the world? He asked, how can I create the intelligence, the operating system, that will control all computers? This distinction is one core reason why Microsoft became not just a successful software company, but also the dominant force in computing, still controlling nearly 90% of the world's personal computer market. However, Gates was slow to master the web because his focus was on what was inside the computer. But the Google boys, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, asked, how do we organize the entire world's information and make it accessible and useful? As a result, they focused on an even more powerful force in technology, life, and business. A higher-level question gave them a higher-level answer, and the rewards that come with it. To get results, you can't just ask the question once. You have to become obsessed with finding its greatest answers. The average person asks questions such as, how do I get by, or why is this happening to me? Some even ask questions that disempower them, causing their minds to focus on and find roadblocks instead of solutions. Questions like, how come I can never lose weight, or why can't I ever hang on to my money, only move them further down the path of limitation. I have been obsessed with the question of how do I make things better, How do I help people to significantly improve the quality of their lives now? This focus has driven me for 38 years to find or create strategies and tools that can make an immediate difference. What about you? What questions do you ask more than any other? What do you focus on most often? What's your life's obsession? Finding love, making a difference, learning, earning, pleasing everyone, avoiding pain or changing the world? Are you aware of what you focus on most, your primary question in life? Whatever it is, it will shape, mold, and direct your life. This book answers the question, what do the most effective investors do to consistently succeed? What are the decisions and actions of those who start with nothing but manage to create wealth and financial freedom for their families? In the financial world, Ray Dalio became obsessed with a series of better quality questions. Questions that led him to ultimately create the all-weather portfolio. It's the approach you are about to learn here and has the potential to change your financial life for the better forever. What kind of investment portfolio would one need to have to be absolutely certain that it would perform well in good times and in bad across all economic environments? This might sound like an obvious question, and in fact many experts and financial advisors would say that the diversified asset allocation they are using is designed to do just that. But the conventional answer to this question is why so many professionals were down 30% to 50% in 2008. We saw how many target date funds got slaughtered when they were supposed to be set up to be more conservative as they neared retirement age. We saw Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old bedrock institution, collapse within days. It was a time when most financial advisors were hiding under their desks and dodging client phone calls. One friend of mine painfully joked, "My 401k is now a 201k. All the fancy software that the industry uses, the Monte Carlo simulations that calculate all sorts of potential scenarios in the future, didn't predict or protect investors from the crash of 1987, the collapse of 2000, the destruction of 2008. The list goes on. If you remember those days back in 2008, the standard answers were, "This just hasn't happened before. We are in uncharted waters. It's different this time." Ray doesn't buy those answers, which is why he predicted the 2008 global financial crisis and made money in 2008. Make no mistake, what Ray calls surprises will always look different from the time before. The Great Depression, the 1973 oil crisis, the rapid inflation of the late 70s, the British sterling crisis of 1976, Black Monday in 1987, the dot-com bubble of 2000, the housing bust in 2008, the 28% drop in gold prices in 2013. All of these surprises caught most investments professionals way off guard. And the next surprise will have them on their heels again. That we can be sure of. But in 2009, once the smoke had cleared and the market started to bounce back, very few money managers stopped to ask if their conventional approach to asset allocation and risk management might have been wrong to begin with. Many of them dusted themselves off, got back in the selling saddle, and prayed that things would just get back to normal. But remember Ray's mantra, expect surprises, and his core operating question, what don't I know? It's not a question of whether or not there will be another crash. It's a question of when. Markowitz, the secret to maximizing returns. Harry Markowitz is known as the father of modern portfolio theory. He explains the fundamental concept behind the work that won him the Nobel Prize. In short, investments in a portfolio should not just be looked at individually, but rather as a group. There is a trade-off for risk and return, so don't just listen to one instrument. Listen to the entire orchestra. And how your investments perform together, how well they are diversified, will ultimately determine your reward. This advice might sound simple now, but in 1952, this thinking was groundbreaking. At some level, this understanding has influenced virtually every portfolio manager from New York to Hong Kong. Like all great investors, Ray stood on Markowitz's shoulders, using his core insights as a basis for thinking about the design of any portfolio or asset allocation. But he wanted to take it to another level. He was sure that he could add a couple more key distinctions, pull a couple key levers, and create his own groundbreaking discovery. He took his 4 decades of investing experience and rounded up his troops to focus their brain power on this project. Ray literally spent years refining his research until he had arrived at a completely new way to look at asset allocation, the ultimate in maximizing returns and minimizing risk. And his discoveries have given him a new level of competitive advantage, an advantage that will soon become yours. Up until this book's publication, Ray's life-altering discovery and game-changing approach has been for the exclusive benefits of his clients. Governments, pension plans, billionaires, all get the extraordinary investment advantages that you are about to learn through Ray's all-weather strategy. As I mentioned, it's where Ray has serious skin in the game. It's where he invests all of his family and legacy money alongside the security buckets of the most conservative and sophisticated institutions in the world. Like Ray, I also now invest a portion of my family's money in this approach, as well as my foundation's money, because as you'll begin to see, it has produced results in every past economic environment over the last 85 years, from depressions and recessions to times of inflation or deflation, in good times and in bad. This strategy has found a way to maximize opportunity. Historically, it appears to be one of the best approaches possible to achieving my wishes long after I am gone. Game day. To be able to sit with yet another one of the great investment legends of our time was truly a gift. I spent close to 15 hours studying and preparing for my time with Ray, combing over every resource I could get my hands on, which was tough because he typically avoids media and publicity. I dug up some rare speeches he gave to world leaders at Davos and the Council on Foreign Relations. I watched his interview with Charlie Rose of 60 Minutes, one of his only major media appearances. I watched his instructional video, How the Economic Machine Works, at the economicprinciples.org website. It's a brilliant video I highly encourage you to watch to really understand in 30 minutes how the world economy works. I combed through every white paper and article I could find. I read and highlighted virtually every page of his famous text, Principles, which covers both his life and management guiding principles. This was an opportunity of a lifetime, and I wasn't going to walk in without being completely prepared. What was supposed to be a 1-hour interview quickly turned into nearly 3. Little did I know, Ray was a fan of my work and had been listening to my audio programs for almost 20 years. What an honor. We went deep. We were pitching and catching on everything from investing to how the world economic machine really works. I began with a simple question of, is the game still winnable for the individual investor? Yes, he said emphatically, but you certainly aren't going to do it listening to your broker buddy, and you certainly aren't going to do it by trying to time the market. Timing the market is basically playing poker with the best players in the world who play round the clock with nearly unlimited resources. There are only so many poker chips on the table. It's a zero-sum game. So to think you are going to take chips away from guys like Ray is more than wishful thinking. It's delusional. There is a world game going on, and only a handful actually make money, and they make a lot by taking chips from the players who aren't as good. As the old saying goes, if you have been at the poker table for a while and you still don't know who the sucker is, it's you. Ray put the final warning stamp on trying to beat and time the market. You don't want to be in that game. Okay, Ray, so we know we shouldn't try to beat the best players in the world, so let me ask you what I've asked every person I've interviewed for this book. If you couldn't leave any of your financial wealth to your children but only a portfolio, a specific asset allocation with a list of principles to guide them, what would it be? Ray sat back, and I could see his hesitancy for a moment. Not because he didn't want to share, but because we live in an incredibly complex world of risk and opportunity. Tony, that's just too complex. It's very hard for me to convey to the average individual in a short amount of time, and things are constantly changing. Fair enough. You can't cram 47 years of experience into a 3-hour interview. But I pressed him a bit. Yeah, I agree, Ray. But you also just told me how the individual investor is not going to succeed by using a traditional wealth manager. So help us understand what we can do to succeed. We all know that asset allocation is the most important part of our success, so what are some of the principles that you would use to create maximum reward with minimum risk? And that's when Ray began to open up and share some amazing secrets and insights. His first step was to shatter my conventional window and show me that conventional wisdom on what is a balanced portfolio is not balanced at all. The secret of all victory lies in the organization of the non-obvious. Marcus Aurelius. Unbalanced. Most advisors and advertisements will encourage you to have a balanced portfolio. Balance sounds like a good thing, right? Balance tells us that we aren't taking too much risk, and that our more risky investments are offset by our more conservative ones. But the question lingers. Why did most conventional balanced portfolios drop 25% to 40% when the bottom fell out of the market? The conventional balanced portfolios are divided up between 50% stocks and 50% bonds, or maybe 60-40 if you're a bit more aggressive, or 70-30 if you're even more aggressive. But let's stick with 50-50 for the sake of this example. That would mean if someone has $10,000, he would invest $5,000 in stocks and $5,000 in bonds, or similarly, $100,000 would mean $50,000 in bonds and $50,000 in stocks. You get the idea. By using this typical balanced approach, we are hoping for three things. One, we hope stocks will do well. Two, we hope bonds will do well. Three, we hope both don't go down at the same time when the next crash comes. It's hard not to notice that hope is the foundation of this typical approach. But insiders like Ray Dalio don't rely on hope. Hope is not a strategy when it comes to your family's well-being. Risky business. By dividing up your money in 50% stocks and 50% bonds, or some general variation thereof, many would think that they are diversifying and spreading out their risk. But in reality, you really are taking much more risk than you think. Why? Because as Ray emphatically pointed out multiple times during our conversation, stocks are three times more risky, aka volatile, than bonds. Tony, by having a 50-50 portfolio, you really have more like 95% of your risk in stocks. So in percentage terms, with 50% of your money in stocks, it seems relatively balanced at first glance. But dividing the same portfolio in terms of risk, you would have closer to 95% or more at risk because of the size and volatility of your stock holdings. Thus, if stocks tank, the whole portfolio tanks. So much for balance. How does this concept translate to real life? From 1973 through 2013, the S&P 500 has lost money 9 times, and the cumulative losses totaled 134%. During the same period, bonds, represented by the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, lost money just 3 times, and the cumulative losses were just 6%. So if you had a 50-50 portfolio, the S&P 500 accounted for over 95% of your losses. Ray said, "Tony, when you look at most portfolios, they have a very strong bias to do well in good times and bad in bad times. And thus, your de facto strategy is simply hoping that stocks go up. This conventional approach to diversifying investments isn't diversifying at all." I had never heard this concept of balance versus risk explained so simply. As I sat there, I started to think back to my own investments and where I may have made some wrong assumptions. So let me ask you, how does this understanding make you feel about your balanced portfolio now? Does this change your view as to what it means to be diversified? I sure hope so. Most people try to protect themselves by diversifying the amount of money they put into certain investment assets. One might say 50% of my money is in risky stocks, with perhaps greater upside potential if things go well, and 50% of my money is going in secure bonds to protect me. Ray is showing us that if your money is divided equally, yet your investments are not equal in their risk, you are not balanced. You are really still putting most of your money at risk. You have to divide up your money based on how much risk/reward there is, not just in equal amounts of dollars in each type of investment. You now know something that 99% of investors don't know and that most professionals don't know or implement. But don't feel bad. Ray says most of the big institutions with hundreds of billions of dollars are making the same mistake. Rainmaker. Ray was now on a roll and was systematically dissecting everything I'd been taught or sold over the years. Tony, there is another major problem with the balanced portfolio theory. It's based around a giant and unfortunately inaccurate assumption. It's the difference between correlation and causation. Correlation is a fancy investment word for when things move together. In primitive cultures, they would dance in an attempt to make it rain. Sometimes it actually worked, or so they thought. They confused causation with correlation. In other words, they thought their jumping up and down caused the rain, but it was actually just coincidence. And if it happened more and more often, they would build some false confidence around their ability to predict the correlation between their dancing and the rain. Investment professionals often buy into the same mythology. They say that certain investments are either correlated, move together, or uncorrelated, have no predictable relationship. And yes, at times they may be correlated, but like the rainmaker, it's often just happenstance. Ray and his team have shown that all historical data points to the fact that many investments have completely random correlations. The 2008 economic collapse destroyed this glaring assumption when almost all asset classes plummeted in unison. The truth is, sometimes they move together, sometimes they don't. So when the professionals try to create balance, hoping stocks move in the opposite direction of bonds, for example, it's a complete crapshoot. But this faulty logic is the underpinning of what most financial professionals use as their true north. Ray has clearly uncovered some glaring holes in the traditional asset allocation model. If he were a professor at an Ivy League school and had published this work, he probably would have been nominated for a Nobel Prize for this critical insight. But in the trenches, in the jungle, is where Ray would rather live. The Four Seasons. When I talked with David Swensen, Yale's chief investment officer, he told me that unconventional wisdom is the only way you can succeed. Follow the herd, and you don't have a chance. Oftentimes, people hear the same advice or thinking over and over again and mistake it for the truth. But it's unconventional wisdom that usually leads to the truth, and more often, leads to a competitive advantage. And here's where Ray's second piece of unconventional wisdom came crashing in. Tony, when looking back through history, there is one thing we can see with absolute certainty. Every investment has an ideal environment in which it flourishes. In other words, there's a season for everything. Take real estate, for example. Look back to the early 2000s when Americans were buying whatever they could get their hands on, including people with little money. But they weren't just buying homes because interest rates were low. Interest rates were even lower in 2009 and they couldn't give houses away. People were buying during the boom because prices were rapidly inflating. Home prices were rising every single month, and they didn't want to miss out. Billionaire investing icon George Soros points out that Americans have added more household mortgage debt in the last 6 years, by 2007, than in the prior life of the mortgage market. That's right. More loans were issued in 6 years than in the entire history of home loans. In Miami and many parts of South Florida, you could put a deposit down, and because of inflationary prices, before the condo was even finished being built, you could sell it for a sizable profit. And what did people do with that home equity? They used their home like an ATM and spent it. And that massive spending stimulated the profitability of corporations and the growth of the economy. Soros cited some staggering numbers. Martin Feldstein, a former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, estimated that from 1997 through 2006, consumers drew more than $9 trillion in cash out of their home equity. To put this in perspective, in just 6 years, from 2001 to 2007, Americans added more household mortgage debt, about $5.5 trillion, than in the prior life of the mortgage market, which is more than a century old. Of course, this national behavior is not a sustainable way to live. When home prices dropped like a rock, so did spending and the economy. In summary, which season or environment can powerfully drive home prices? Inflation. But in 2009, we experienced deflation, when prices sank and many mortgage holders were left with a home underwater, worth less than what they owed. Deflation drops the price of this investment class. How about stocks? They too perform well during inflation. With inflation comes rising prices. Higher prices means companies have the opportunity to make more money, and rising revenues means growth in stock prices. This has proven true over time. Bonds are a different animal. Take U.S. Treasury bonds, for example. If we have a season of deflation, which is accompanied by falling interest rates, bond prices will rise. Ray then revealed the most simple and important distinction of all. There are only four things that move the prices of assets. 1. Inflation. 2. Deflation. 3. Rising economic growth. And 4. Declining economic growth. Ray's view boils it down to only four different possible environments or economic seasons that will ultimately affect whether investments, asset prices, go up or down, except, unlike nature, there is not a predetermined order in which the seasons will arrive. They are 1. Higher than expected inflation, rising prices. 2. Lower than expected inflation, or deflation. 3. Higher than expected economic growth. And 4. Lower than expected economic growth. When you look at a stock or bond priced today, the price already incorporates what we, the market, expect about the future. Ray said to me, "Tony, there is a literal picture of the future when you look at prices today." In other words, the price of Apple's stock today incorporates the expectations of investors who believe the company will continue to grow at a certain pace. This is why you may have heard that a stock will fall when a company says that its future growth or earnings will be lower than it had initially expected. It's the surprises that will ultimately determine which asset class will do well. If we have a real growth surprise, that would be very good for stocks and not great for bonds. For bonds, if we have a surprise drop in inflation, it will be good for bonds. If there are only four potential economic environments or seasons, Ray says you should have 25% of your risk in each of these four categories. He explains, "I know that there are good and bad environments for all asset classes, and I know that in one's lifetime there will be a ruinous environment for one of those asset classes. That's been true throughout history." This is why he calls this approach all-weather. Because there are four possible seasons in the financial world, and nobody really knows which season will come next. With this approach, each season, each quadrant, is covered all the time, so you're always protected. Ray elaborates, "I imagine four portfolios, each with an equal amount of risk in them. That means I would not have an exposure to any particular environment." How cool is that? We aren't trying to predict the future because nobody knows what the future holds. What we do know is that there are only four potential seasons we will all face. By using this investment strategy, we can know that we are protected and not merely hoping that our investments are sheltered and will do well in any season that comes our way. Bob Prince, the co-chief investments officer at Bridgewater, describes the uniqueness of the all-weather approach. "Today, we can structure a portfolio that will do well in 2022, even though we can't possibly know what the world will look like in 2022. I honestly sat there with my jaw open because nobody had ever described to me such a simple yet elegant solution. It makes perfect sense to have investments equally divided up by risk that will do well in all seasons. But how you actually accomplish this is the golden ticket." So we know the four potential seasons, but which type of investment will perform well in each of these environments? Ray responded by categorizing them into each season. Season 1. Rising economic growth. Investments that would perform well are stocks, corporate bonds, and commodities/gold. Season 2. Rising inflation. Investments are commodities/gold and inflation-protected bonds, or TIPS. Season 3. Falling economic growth. Investments in treasury bonds and inflation-protected bonds, TIPS. Season 4. Deflation. Investments in treasury bonds and stocks. Two down, one to go. On the surface, asset allocation might sometimes feel complex, even when you understand the principles that Ray has laid out. But there's one thing I know for sure. Complexity is the enemy of execution. If you and I are actually going to get ourselves to follow through with this process and receive the rewards, I had to find a way to make this advice even simpler. So I said to Ray, What you have shared with us here is invaluable, a completely different way of looking at asset allocation. By now we all know asset allocation is one of the single most important keys to all successful investing. But the challenge for the average investor, and even for the sophisticated investor, is how to take these principles and translate them into an actual portfolio with the most effective percentages of each asset class. It will be too complex for 99% of us to figure out. So it would be a huge gift if you could share the specific percentages that people would invest in each asset class so that their risk would be equally divided amongst seasons. Ray looked at me and I could see the wheels turning. Tony, it's not really that simple. Ray explained that in his all-weather strategy, they use very sophisticated investment instruments and they also use leverage to maximize returns. I understood where Ray was coming from, so I asked him for a more simplified version. Can you give me the percentages that the average person can do without any leverage to get the best returns with the least amount of risk? I know it's not going to be your absolute perfect asset allocation because I'm putting you on the spot to create it right here and now. Ray, your best estimate will certainly be greater than most people's best plan. Could you give a version of the all-weather portfolio that listeners could do on their own or with the help of a fiduciary advisor? Ray has taken very few investors in the last 10 years, and the last time he did, you had to be an institutional investor with $5 billion in investable assets, and your initial investment needed to be a minimum of $100 million just to get Ray's advice. This helps you understand what a big ask I was making. But I know how much he cares about the little guy. He certainly hasn't forgotten his roots as a self-made man from humble beginnings in Queens, New York. Ray, I know you've got a huge heart to help, so let's give folks a recipe for success. You won't take anybody's money even if they're worth $5 billion today. Help your brothers and sisters out, I said with a big smile. And then something magical happened. I looked in Ray's eyes, and a smile came across his face. All right, Tony. It wouldn't be exact or perfect, but let me give you a sample portfolio that the average person could implement. And then slowly, he began to unfold the exact sequence, the exact recipe for what his experience shows will give you and me the increased probability of the highest return in any market environment as long as we live with the least amount of risk. Drumroll, please. You are about to hear the exact asset allocation built by a man who many call the best asset allocator to walk the planet. A self-made man who built himself from nothing financially to a net worth of over $14 billion and who manages $160 billion a year and produces annual returns of more than 21% for his investors before fees. Here he shares not only which type of investment, but also what percentage of each asset class you need to win. In fact, if you look online, many people have tried to replicate a version of this based upon Ray's previous interviews. In fact, there is a whole new category of investment products now called risk parity based on Ray's innovations. Many funds or strategies say they were inspired by Ray's approach, but nobody received the specific allocation like Ray provided here. Many of the replicas were down as much as 30% or more in 2008. More like some weather than all weather, if you ask me. A fake Rolex will never be a real Rolex. A quick note. The strategy that follows is not the same as Ray's all-weather strategy, of course. As he said, his fund uses more sophisticated investments and also uses leverage. But the core principles are the same, and the specific percentages are designed directly by Ray and no one else. So let's call this portfolio herein the All Seasons Portfolio. Give me the numbers. So tell me, Ray, what are the percentages you would put in stocks? What percentage in gold? And so on. He graciously proceeded to sketch out the following breakdown. First, he said, we need 30% in stocks, for instance, the S&P 500 or other indexes for further diversification in this basket. Initially, that sounded low to me, but remember, stocks are three times more risky than bonds. And who am I to second-guess the Yoda of asset allocation? Then you need long-term government bonds, 15% in intermediate term, 7 to 10-year treasuries, and 40% in long-term bonds, 20 to 25-year treasuries. Why such a large percentage, I asked. because this counters the volatility of the stocks. I quickly remembered it's about balancing risk, not the dollar amounts. And by going out to longer-term duration bonds, this allocation will bring a potential for higher returns. He rounded out the portfolio with 7.5% in gold and 7.5% in commodities. You need to have a piece of that portfolio that will do well with accelerated inflation, so you would want a percentage in gold and commodities. These have high volatility because they're environments where rapid inflation can hurt both stocks and bonds. Lastly, the portfolio must be rebalanced, meaning when one segment does well, you must sell a portion and reallocate back to the original allocation. This should be done at least annually, and if done properly, it can actually increase the tax efficiency. This is part of the reason why I recommend having a fiduciary implement and manage this crucial ongoing process. Gratitude. Wow, there it was. Ray had masterfully and graciously provided a game-changing recipe that would impact the lives of millions of Americans. Do you realize the level of generosity this man provided both you and me that wonderful day? Giving from the heart is at the core of who Ray is, which is why I wasn't the least bit surprised to learn later that he and his wife Barbara have signed the Giving Pledge, a commitment by the world's wealthiest individuals from Bill Gates to Warren Buffett to give the majority of their wealth away to philanthropy. Do I have your attention now? When my own investment team showed me the back-tested performance numbers of this all-seasons portfolio, I was astonished. I will never forget it. I was sitting with my wife at dinner and received a text message from my personal advisor, AJ Gupta, that read, "Did you see the email with the back-tested numbers on the portfolio that Ray Dalio shared with you? Unbelievable." AJ normally doesn't text me at night, so I knew he couldn't wait to share. As soon as our dinner date was over, I grabbed my phone and opened the email. Chapter 5.2. It's time to thrive. Stormproof returns and unrivaled results. If no mistake have you made, yet losing you are, a different game you should play. Yoda. The proof is in the pudding. It's safe to say that in the past 80-plus years, we've experienced every possible economic season and more than a handful of surprises. From the Great Depression to the Great Recession and everything in between. So how did the All Seasons portfolio perform? As I mentioned, I took it to a team of analysts to have it tested extensively all the way back to 1925. The results astonished everyone. We already saw in the previous chapter how the All Seasons approach did over 40 years, so let's dig a little deeper. But let's take a look at how it did during what I call the modern period, 30 years from 1984 through 2013. The portfolio was rock solid. Just under 10%, precisely 9.72% net of fees, average annualized return. It's important to note that this is the actual return, not an inflated average return. You would have made money just over 86% of the time. That's only 4 down/negative years. The average loss was just 1.9%, and one of the four losses was just 0.03%, essentially a break-even year. So effectively, you would have lost money only 3 out of 30 years. The worst down year was minus 3.93% in 2008, when the S&P 500 was down 37%. Investor nerd alert. Standard deviation was just 7.63%. This means extremely low risk and low volatility. Why did we select the modern period from 1984? This time frame marks the beginning of the 401k plan, when every American became an investor and no longer was the stock market just for the sophisticated. For some perspective, 30 years ago there was no World Wide Web. Heck, the first portable handheld cell phones came out in 1984. The Motorola Dynatac was a beige brick that cost nearly $4,000. The plan itself also cost $50 a month and 50 cents per minute, but you could talk only for 30 minutes before the battery died. I know because I'm ancient enough to be one of the first proud owners. But let's not just point out the positive. Let's look at how the portfolio held up in the worst times, the economic winters. This analysis is what the industry calls stress testing. If you look at what I call the historical period from 1939 to 2013, 75 years, consider these startling stats. The S&P versus all seasons, a 75-year history. In 75 years, the S&P lost money 18 times. In the same time period, the All Seasons portfolio lost money just 10 times, slightly more than once a decade on average. The S&P's largest single loss was -43.3%. The All Seasons' single largest loss was just -3.93%. The S&P's average loss was -11.4%. The All Seasons was only -1.63%. Now let's go back even further, all the way back to 1927, which includes the worst decade in our economic history, the Great Depression. In 87 years, through 2013, the S&P lost money 24 times, roughly 27% of the time. The All Seasons portfolio lost money only 14 times during the same period. That means 75 years of positive returns. In the heart of the Depression, the four consecutive losing years, 1929 to 1932, the S&P lost 64.4%. During the same four-year period, the All Seasons had a total loss of 20.55%, or 59% better than the S&P. Since 1928, the S&P's average loss was 13.66%. The All Seasons' average loss was just 3.65%. Please note that in order to go back further in time, we had to use different indexes to represent the asset allocation, because certain indexes didn't exist prior to 1983. Also, at the end of this chapter, I'll explain the methodology used. If a house is deemed stormproof, the only way to know for sure is to endure the test of time and the worst of storms. In the seven worst drops since 1935, the All Seasons portfolio was actually up in two out of seven of those winters. And the losses it did sustain were relatively small in comparison with the U.S. stock market. Talk about bucking the trend. While winter was kicking everyone's butt, this portfolio would have allowed you to spend the winter skiing or snowboarding and enjoying your hot chocolate. If you look at how the All Seasons portfolio would have performed against the market in more recent years, the difference is even greater. The All Seasons portfolio from January 1, 2000 through March 31, 2014 literally destroyed the returns of the market, the S&P 500. During this time frame, we endured all kinds of what Ray calls surprises: the tech crash, the credit crisis, the European debt crisis, and the largest single year drop in gold, down 28% in 2013, in more than a decade. This time frame includes what experts call the lost decade, in which the S&P 500 was flat for 10 years, from the beginning of 2000 to the end of 2009. It's fascinating and quite sad that we live in a time where the media is salivating to take down anyone considered to be best in class. Culture seems to lift them onto a pedestal of perfection, only to hope they come crashing down. Whether it's an athlete, a CEO, or a money manager, any false move or seemingly slight crack in the armor is exploited to the fullest. Stone them in the town square of television and the internet. I found it mind-boggling that with more than 30 years of stellar returns, Ray's all-weather strategy received intense criticism when he was down approximately 4% in 2013. A whopping 4%. Not a whopping 37%, the hit that the S&P took just a few years earlier. Remember, based on history, the All Seasons approach will take losses, but the goal is to minimize those dramatic drops. Let's be honest, you could buy into this portfolio and see a loss the first year. This portfolio is not meant to shoot out the lights. It's a long-term approach for the smoothest possible ride. It would be a mistake to judge it by any single year, but rather we need to evaluate its overall long-term performance, like any other investment opportunity. At the time of this writing, mid-2014, the media is back on the Dalio bandwagon, as his all-weather fund was up 11% through June. Imagine all this media attention over a 4% loss. Never mind that over the last 5 years, between 2009 and 2013, the all-weather has averaged over 11% per year, even including this single down year. But the fact he lost even a small amount when the market was up, and that he received big media attention, shows how his incredible performance has become expected. You are only as good as your last at-bat when it comes to the financial media. How ridiculous. Never mind the fact that Ray's clients have enjoyed incredible returns year after year, decade after decade, as The New Yorker reported in a 2011 article on Bridgewater called Mastering the Machine. In 2007, Dalio predicted that the housing and lending boom would end badly. Later that year, he warned the Bush administration that many of the world's largest banks were on the verge of insolvency. In 2008, a disastrous year for many of Bridgewater's rivals, the firm's flagship Pure Alpha Fund rose in value by 9.5% after accounting for fees. Last year, the Pure Alpha Fund rose 45%, the highest return of any big hedge fund. The point is, there are a number of pundits who will sit back and criticize any strategy you may deploy. To echo my favorite quote from Dr. David Babel, let them criticize, let us sleep. Good questions. When it comes to the all-weather approach, the biggest question from the bloggers is, what happens when interest rates go up? Won't the government bonds go down and cause a loss to the portfolio because of the large percentage allocated to bonds? It's a fair question, but deserves more than a soundbite from an armchair quarterback. First, remember that by having a large allocation to bonds, it's not a bet on bonds alone. This portfolio spreads your risk among the four potential economic seasons. Ray showed us that the point is not to plan for a specific season or pretend to know what season is coming next. Remember, it's the surprises that will catch most off guard. In fact, many have been trying to proselytize and predict the next season by calling for interest rates to rise quickly. After all, we are at all-time lows. Michael O'Higgins, author of the famous book Beating the Dow, says that people may be waiting quite some time for any significant interest rate increases, since the Fed has a history of suppressing interest rates for long periods to keep costs of borrowing low. To the great number of investors who believe interest rates will inevitably go higher in the coming year, 2014, remember that the U.S. Fed kept long duration rates below 3% for 22 years from 1934 to 1956. The Fed has kept rates low since 2008, so who knows how long interest rates will remain low. Nobody can tell you with certainty. In early 2014, when everyone was expecting rates to rise, they dropped yet again and caused a spike in U.S. bond prices. Remember, as rates go down, prices go up. How did the all seasons perform in a rising interest rate market? A revealing exercise is to look back in history at what happened to the all seasons portfolio during a season when interest rates rose like a hot air balloon. After interest rates declined for many decades, the 1970s brought rapid inflation. Despite skyrocketing interest rates, the all-seasons portfolio had just a single losing year in the 1970s and had an annualized return of 9.68% during the decade. This includes enduring the back-to-back drops of 1973 and 1974, when the S&P lost 14.31% and then another 25.9% loss, for a cumulative loss of 40.21%. So let's not let the talking heads persuade us to believe that they know what season is coming next. But let's certainly prepare for all seasons and the series of surprises that lay ahead. Let's get real. One final and crucial advantage of the all seasons portfolio has a much more human element. Many critics will point out that if you could stomach more risk, you might have been able to beat this all-seasons approach. And they would be right. But the point of the all-seasons portfolio is to reduce volatility slash risk while still maximizing gains. If you are younger and have a longer time horizon, or you are willing to stomach more risk, you could still take advantage of the all-seasons foundation but make a small adjustment in the stocks versus bonds to hopefully produce a greater return. But keep in mind, by adding more stocks and decreasing your bonds, this change will increase risk slash volatility and have you betting more on one season, in which you hope stocks will go up. In the past, this has worked quite well. If you visit the Stronghold website, you can see how over time, by adding more stocks, the portfolio would have produced greater returns, but also produced greater downside in certain years. But here is what's incredibly interesting. When compared with the standard 60%-40% balanced portfolio, 60% in the S&P 500 and 40% in the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, the all-seasons approach with more stock exposure outperformed handily. And you would have to have accepted nearly 80% more risk, standard deviation, with a traditional 60-40 portfolio to still achieve results that would still fall slightly short of the all-seasons with increased equity focus. But let's be honest with ourselves. Our stomach lining is much weaker than we let on. The research firm Dalbar revealed the truth about our appetite for risk. For the 20-year period from December 31, 1993 to December 31, 2013, the S&P 500 returned 9.2% annually, but the average mutual fund investor averaged just over 2.5%, barely beating inflation. To put this in perspective, you would have received a better return by investing in 3-month U.S. Treasuries, which is nearly a cash equivalent, and avoided the stomach-turning drops. Why did the average investor leave so much on the table? Dalbar President Lewis Harvey says investors move their money in and out of the market at the wrong times. They get excited or they panic, and they hurt themselves. One of the more startling examples is a study conducted by Fidelity on the performance of its flagship Magellan Mutual Fund. If you recall, the fund was run by investment legend Peter Lynch, who delivered an astonishing 29% average annual return between 1977 and 1990. But Fidelity found that the average Magellan investor actually lost money. How in the world? Fidelity showed that when the fund was down, people would cash in, scared of the possibility of losing more. And when the fund was up again, they would come running back like the prodigal investor. Here is the reality. Most people couldn't stomach another 2008 without selling some or all of their investments. It's human nature. So when people talk about better performance, for the most part, they are talking about a fictitious investor, one with nerves of steel and a drawer full of Tums. Case in point, I was reading MarketWatch recently and came across an article by Mark Hulbert. Mark's financial publication tracks the performance of subscription newsletters that tell investors exactly how to trade the markets. The best performing newsletter over 20 years was up 16.3% annually. Outstanding performance, to say the least. But with the ups come major downs. As Mark explains, that high-flying performance can be stomach-churning, with his performance during the downturns of the last three market cycles since 2000 among the very worst of his peers. During the 2007-2009 bear market, for example, the service's average model portfolio lost nearly two-thirds of its value. Two-thirds? That's 66%. Can you imagine investing $100,000 and now seeing only $33,000 on your monthly statement? Or $1 million of your life savings reduced to just $333,000? Would you have white-knuckled it and held on? When Mark asked the newsletter publisher about whether or not investors could actually hang on during the roller coaster ride, he provided quite the understatement by saying in an email that his approach isn't for an investor who bails out of his or her broadly diversified portfolio the first time a worry arises. I would call a 66% drop more than a worry. He makes it sound like we mere mortals are prone to overreaction, as though I jumped out of a moving car when the check engine light came on. Remember, a 66% loss would require nearly 200% gains just to get back to even, just to recoup the portion of your nest egg that it may have taken your entire life to save. Without exception, the money masters I interviewed for this book are obsessed with not losing their money. They understand that when you lose, you have to make significantly more to get back to where you started, to get back to breaking even. For instance, if you lose 10%, the gain required to break even is 11%. For a 15% loss, the gain required to break even is 18%. A 20% loss requires a 25% gain. Jumping into further bigger loss examples, a 40% loss requires a 67% gain to break even. A 50% loss requires a 100% gain. And a 75% loss requires a 300% gain just to break even. The reality is, if we are being honest with ourselves, we all make emotional decisions about our investments. We are all emotional creatures, and even the best traders in the world are always fighting the inner fear. This all-seasons portfolio not only protects you from any potential environment, it also protects you from yourself. It provides emotional scaffolding to keep you from making poor decisions. If your worst down year in the last 7